This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
We're going to get started. I am very, 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 very thrilled to have so many folks come out to have a discussion. It's 90 minutes, so it'll definitely be a lot of discussion instead of me talking about... I'm from Teach for America, but it's also a broader discussion about educational inequity, and especially from a Christian perspective. So you can just read over a few quotes. The first quote has a question mark because someone told me that Warren Buffett said it. I don't have proof that Warren Buffett said it, but I thought it was a really interesting statement. Actually, folks, if anyone objects to being cold called, look down when I start to ask people questions, I won't call on you. Jennifer, you want to read the first quote?
Sure. Do you want to solve the issues in public education? Make private schools illegal and tell parents their children will be randomly assigned to some public school in their area.
So, where are you from? What area are you from?
Chicago.
Chicago. So you can imagine something like that in Chicago. Hey, your kid's going to be randomly assigned to some public school in Chicago. A lot of really, really smart people would start coming up with some really, really great ideas about solving the issues of public education. John, can you read just any one of the quotes? I mean, there's so many things in the Bible that lead us to care about this issue. Okay.
But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him?
Okay, so just to kind of round our conversation, we're here because we are servants of Christ, and so we have a leading to do things that are of Christ, and so to kind of just anchor that. You should know before I start, Teach for America is a secular organization, so the Christian perspective is of mine, which kind of actually goes right into disclaimers, assumptions, mindsets. So I personally am a fan of Jesus and an enthusiast for educational equity. I'm not a theologian, not even close to one, so keep that in mind. I'm going to assume we are a community of writers and reflectors. And then mindsets and also assumptions that we strive toward a just world that offers opportunity to all people, rich as well as poor, and that we desire and work toward a more just world for all. These are very dense, but I kind of am partial to them. So I don't know your name. Can you read James 2, 1 through 4?
My brothers, as believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, don't show favoritism. Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, "Here's a good seat for you," but say to the poor man, "You stand there," or "Sit on the floor by my feet," have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil?
Yesterday I was in the social sciences track, and one thing that, is Dr. Cannon? And one thing she was talking about was when she did her graduate work as a graduate student at Penn and went to work at the local high school and saw that students didn't have textbooks. She's like, how can that be? Like, how do you even learn without textbooks? But that's just a small kind of symptom of some of the bigger problems we can see in terms of educational inequity. All right, so some objectives. And I try to keep myself honest by aligning the whole presentation back to one of these four objectives. So my goals, and if folks have additional goals, you can kind of chime in. Session participants will understand the magnitude of the problem of educational inequity. Raise your hand if you already are pretty familiar with the issue and that's why you're here. Okay, so we'll probably get through that very quickly. Have evidence that educational inequity and other social injustices are solvable. I think that's all a constant work in progress, even for me, even for you all, even for all of us who are working towards social justice. It's kind of we need a constant inspiration to believe that it's possible and solvable. Develop our own personal testimony and perspective on educational equity, preferably based on a Christian worldview, and then finally generate solutions and kind of to the theme of human flourishing, figuring out ways that we can all do be a part of the work towards ending educational inequity, whether or not we want to teach or whether or not we want to be a part of it in some other way. All right, so I'm going to shut up soon, I promise. Teach for America's vision. One day, all children, this gets back to the previous quotes, one day all children in our nation will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. And just kind of brief what we do, recruit, select, train, and support high-achieving leaders of all academic and professional backgrounds. 95% of our folks actually aren't education majors, but education majors are, of course, welcome also. To serve for 2 years in low-income public and rural communities. I highlight rural because a lot of people think that you go into the inner city. A lot of our placements are in urban communities, but we also have a high need in places like South Dakota, the Mississippi Delta, rural Louisiana, so those are also places. And then after their core experience, Teach for America core members will go on to do amazing things, whether they stay in education or whether they go on to be doctors or lawyers. They bring that experience of actually knowing and working within a community and actually seeing progress, and they take that with them no matter where they go. All right, so faith community relations team, how does this even connect to faith? How am I here at the university conference as part of Teach for America? So we started about 2 years ago. There was a person who goes on campuses to recruit, and she went to UCLA, and she's a Christian, and so she thought, I was motivated to do this by my faith. There got to be other people. So she went to Bel Air Presbyterian and did a presentation there and got a tremendous response. So then she talked to our senior vice president of recruitment, who just happens to be Christian. So she said, I think there's potential here. Let's see. And so they were kind of open to that idea. I was telling Jeffrey, they kind of gave air cover to the idea while other, because it's a secular organization, so there was some pushback. But they kind of were like, we think that there are a lot of people who are motivated by their faith to do this, and can we see if there's potential here? So we think of ourselves as existing to prioritize educational inequity as a key issue requiring action by faith communities. If you think about the civil rights movement, at the forefront of the civil rights movement were largely places of faith. But if you think about so many of our social justice issues in our nation now, there's a shocking absence of communities of faith. So we really want to help faith communities prioritize educational inequity. We also want to increase recruitment of leaders of faith to teach in underserved communities. So really thinking about having future pastors and, you know, leaders of large churches who've worked for 2 years at least in a low-income community, who've been able to show students academic success, who've been able to lead communities and students and families to achieve great things. We think that that will have an amazing impact on our country and in our kind of faith communities. And then the third thing is to strengthen our growth and scale and diversity. So what are some of our results today? We've only been around for a little bit over a year. 40% of incoming core members were led to join Teach for America because of a faith calling. And that was actually even really before we started to do the work that we're doing now. So we expect to see this number growing even more. Last year, 105 InterVarsity members joined Teach for America. In InterVarsity, actually, we've seen for a couple of organizations, the acceptance rate is actually higher than the average. And so even though Teach for America is still very selective, we find that InterVarsity is one of those groups where people tend to get in at a higher rate than standard. Another organization that we've seen, 6% of Teach for America's accepted core members in the first round of 2009 were part of Young Life. These are folks who've already gotten into Teach for America. Teach for America founder Wendy Kopp spoke at Willow Creek to about 100,000 folks. This is something I'm particularly excited about. So we have 10 faith-based campuses that we piloted recruiting at this year. That's like Wheaton College, Olivet Nazarene, Azusa Pacific. They've been the most successful portfolio of like 60 portfolios across Teach for America. So that means there are like 60 different people who go on campuses and recruit, and the people who are recruiting at faith-based campuses have seen the most growth and the most applications than any other. And what's really exciting is it's the difference in perspective. So these campuses have always been within Teach for America, but this is the first time we've put an actual Christian to go recruiting at these campuses, and kind of the difference that perspective can make. And finally, we're seeing things like a Phoenix church donated more than 100,000 to Teach for America in Phoenix. So we're seeing that there is a lot of traction, that faith communities and people of faith really do care about educational inequity. So that's exciting. I talk too fast, so if ever you need to, I used to tell my students that, just go slow down if ever I'm going too fast. All right, so I'm about to tell you my personal testimony, and pay attention because then I'm going to ask you, and that's why I'm giving you some paper, to kind of write about your personal testimony. And I think it'll help you connect with why you even care about educational inequity. So I graduated from Houston Independent School District, which is the public school system in Houston. I went to public schools all my life and was really, really fortunate and blessed that my parents kind of understood how public schools in Houston worked. So the good news was I got an excellent education. The bad news was I spent about 3 hours every day on the bus going past lots of schools that We're not good. My sisters and I, my parents were college educated, so my sisters and I, we all kind of got the same game. But then most of my family members, my parents were my mom was one of eight who went to college, my dad was one of four. So most of my family members went to their neighborhood schools. Some went to college, the ones who did, didn't finish college because they were taking so many remedial classes and paying money to learn things in college that they should have learned in high school that they eventually dropped out. So for me, that's kind of one part of my testimony. I went to Howard University in DC. I love Howard. I had two roommates at Howard in my first suite. My actual roommate who I lived with, she went to public school in New York City. She was probably one of the top five students in her class. She dropped out after the first year. It was just too much, like writing skills, math skills, just wasn't prepared. Was one of the top students in her high school, but still wasn't prepared for college. After Howard, I was a business major. I always had this kind of like, I don't know, do I want to do business? Do I want to do nonprofit? Business, nonprofit. So after college, I did business. Then I went to nonprofit. And at this nonprofit I worked at, we sent students to colleges on full tuition leadership scholarships, and they went in a group. And so there's a couple of students, but one student in particular I can think of who was the valedictorian of her high school. So the valedictorian, you assume this person did everything that their teachers told them to do. She had a 4.0. So she went to Bowdoin College, and her first semester probably failed 4 out of her 5 classes. I mean, just was not, had done everything we told her to do, as, you know, assuming we as taxpayers are really paying for her education. She had done everything we told her to do, but we hadn't really prepared her for college. So, you have a question?
Take it when you have a moment.
Okay. I'm going to pause after this, and then, it'll be a good breaking point. Okay. So, again, I'm having this struggle, nonprofit, and I thought I wanted to teach, but I was like, I'll teach after I make some money, or, you know, I'll teach later in life. So, after policy, I was like, I want to do nonprofit management. Plus, I thought education was dysfunctional, and so I was going to do, like, youth leadership, but I didn't actually want to be in the school systems. So I went to Stanford, got my MBA. After that, I did nonprofit consulting. And that kind of got me into education reform because we had some clients. We worked with the Gates Foundation. They're doing lots of interesting things in education. And so that's how I learned about KIPP, which is a national network of charter schools. And so my husband's back there. Actually, that's where I met him because he leads a KIPP school in Nashville. And so that's also where I really got into schools and started seeing, like, this is what teaching can be. This is what teaching should be. And so that's what kind of finally laid on my heart, like, as one of my friends put it when I was talking about the decision, to give it what I had instead of what I had left at the end of my career. So that's what led me to join Teach for America. And I taught 7th and 8th grade math in Houston. And so that's kind of where I am now. So
at some point in this conversation, I don't know how many people here are college educators, mm-hmm. and your stories about students who arrive at college and inadequately prepared. At any point will we talk about strategies for when that happens, when there are students who have come out of high school unprepared for college, what can we do for them to help them? So you can say, let's talk about that later if you want, but I wanted to ask you.
I would love to, it's not in here, but I would love to have that conversation later also. I think I do maybe have some ideas, but it's, so now kind of similarly,
I know some things about both of these programs, Knowledge and Power Schools, and Teach for America. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you could make some comments about burnout rates experienced by teachers.
Sure.
I taught for 2 years, and, you know, I've been in high schools. It's hard work.
I will say, as a teacher, I don't know where you went to school. I know where I went to school, and the job that I have as a teacher, and that I think it is, it's not the same job that teachers in suburban schools have. It's just not. And the burnout rate is high, and it's not for the faint of heart, and it's hard. And I think 67% of Teach for America core members stay in education, 40% stay in their schools. I think we would all like to see that number even higher. And KIPP, it's hard. It's just hard work. I think there's no way. I think anyone who does work at that level with people, even at, you know, we're talking about even being like something like an RA, like anytime you're that heavily involved in people's lives, it's just, it is hard. I mean, I think that's one of the things that questions that people have frequently about both KIPP and Teach for America and all of this education reform is, gosh, you know, is it sustainable? Don't people get burned out? And I think that's one of the challenges. We have to figure out a way to make it a little less hard, but I think right now we're at the point where we know it's solvable, but we also know that it's a lot of work.
I mean, and I think that there are critical responsibilities that both, I don't think it can happen with people just focusing on, say, K-6, mm-hmm. or just focusing on middle school, mm-hmm. or just focusing on, you know, remedial education in college. I think that all of those pieces need to be synergistically integrated in a way that only God can do.
That's what's amen. Yeah, I think that's true. All right, so we're going to move on quickly. I'm probably going to do better about tracking time. But I want you all to kind of take a few minutes to reflect on your experiences and your testimony. I don't think we pause a lot to think about our educational opportunities. And so kind of take some time to just think about, jot. You don't have to, write full paragraphs. But what blessings have led you? It can be people, it can be a teacher, it can be someone who looked out for you. What led you to your educational opportunities? And what led you to come here even to care about educational opportunities of others? So there must be some seed planted to lead you to care. So you can just take about 3 minutes and then we'll probably share out immediately. And it took about another 30 seconds. Okay, so now take about a minute to just turn. You can do it in twos or threes. And I know this is kind of education can sometimes be a personal experience. Just turn and chat for about a minute about what you said, what you found. If anyone's left over, I can talk to them. Just take a minute to share out what you kind of Reflect on. Human flourishing, like, I mean, that's, I mean, just, I'm, science is not my thing, I would, but of course I had students who were going to be amazing engineers, but everything you're saying would have been a barrier to them. And so to know that you're using your gifts and talents to be in academia to kind of think about those issues and things I would have never, ever thought about.
While still being an engineer and being able to put myself in places where I'll be working with those students who come in needing the type of support that I'm trying to figure out how to do this.
That's awesome. Who else has? You can nominate, yes, you can nominate your neighbor.
This has been a really large concern in our family. Mm-hmm. We lived in Columbus, Ohio. When our children were ready to start school and we're living in a suburb, and one of the questions that really haunted me was, why should my children have the best education when the poor child across town had so much less? We made the decision to move into the city and put our sons in city schools. And with that, I made a commitment to go with them. And for 25 years, I volunteered and worked in the Columbus City Schools. Our sons graduated from Central City High School. One of them went to Harvard, so I think he did all right. I mean, we did. It was not an easy thing to do, and there was a lot of criticism from Christian friends, from our neighbors.
You know, it's interesting, you said there was a teacher who, she hadn't joined Teach for America yet, but she was in a graduate program, and she and some Christian friends had gotten to talk about public education and the problems with public education, and so where it led her friends were, well, yeah, we should be homeschooling our children. She's like, no, like, that's not, you know, we can't just remove our kids and then think, you know, leave everyone else to fend for themselves. We have to take a proactive part, so, I mean, that's awesome.
This is for us. You know, and I'm not saying everyone has to make that same decision, but for our family, both of our sons are involved in ministries, living in the city now in Springfield, Massachusetts.
And then being able to have, I mean, your family in the school and have that example in the school, I mean, I think that's a really powerful example.
One of the things, one of the reasons I came to this seminar, I teach at a small college. Most of my students are first-generation college students. A lot of them come out of poverty, and that is nothing like my upbringing. My great-grandparents went to college. My parents paid for my education, and one of the things I have felt in the years I've taught is that there is a wide gap between me and my students. Mm-hmm. I do not understand the struggles that they're dealing with, and actually, South Chicago is one of the areas that we're pretty heavily from. So our school has been doing some seminars on poverty so we can hopefully kind of start to bridge that gap. But I realize that there's even more. And I see it in my students who are very underprepared for college, trying to figure out what classes I should even put them in if they don't read very well. Mm-hmm. And it becomes just a nightmare sometimes. And we see the students who drop out, and it's something that is very difficult. I don't want to take a student's money, to put them in college and then have them drop out.
And I mean, I wrote the question down that she had, and it's kind of the same thing. And I think this is, it's a bigger societal question that people are starting to have about, you know, we're very much now a society where college is expected, it's kind of a prerequisite, but then we're taking students' money who we know we're taking their money to teach them what they should have learned in high school.
Right.
So, I mean, which is not, that's not fair either.
And we know some of them are not going to make it through.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a challenge. We're only going to stay on the challenges, I mean, for a little while longer. I'll just kind of share a couple of statistics. So, kind of, this is, I think people probably have a sense for this. This is the testimony of our nation's 13 million children living in poverty. And what's kind of crazy is the kids you have who are struggling through college are the good news. I mean, those are the 1 in 10 who are making it to college. Because of the 13 million children living in poverty, only 1 in 10 of them will ever graduate from college. So, I mean, the students who we're seeing struggling through college are actually representing the hope of their communities. Fourth graders growing up in low-income community are already three grade levels behind their high-income peers. And people have seen that and they say, how is that possible? Like, how does that even mathematically work? 9 years old, you start off, they start pre-K with the difference, but it's not as dramatic. I mean, because you think about talking to your child when they're 3 and 4 years old, and then they come in, and if the parent's been reading to them since they were 3 or 4, then they come in and takes off from there. At Randy School in Nashville, your students come in on average at, as fifth graders on the
second grade level
in Nashville. So already 3 grade levels behind their high-income peers. About 50% of students from low-income communities won't graduate from high school by the time they're 18 years old, and the 50% who do graduate will perform on average at an 8th grade level, which is why we're seeing a lot of students who struggle in college. So, as you can probably guess, African American, Latino, Hispanic, and Native American children are 3 times more likely to live in low-income areas, so they are being disproportionately affected by our gap in equity. So I want you to look at these statistics. This is going to be a kind of another reflection exercise. It'll be a little quicker than the last. But which of these kind of speaks to you most? You can kind of just look and think about it. I added a few new ones. One, prisons are built based on 3rd grade reading scores. So when they're predicting how many prisons to build, they base it on the reading, how many 3rd graders are not reading on grade level. In state, so like the state will do it kind of based on.
What's the source of that?
I mean, I can send it to you. I mean, it's actually now it's been cited so many times that it's almost assumed common knowledge. But I can't put a source on here, but I can send it to you. Less than 50% of low-income students will ever have a teacher who is even minored in math or science. In my 8th grade homeroom, only 4 out of 27 of my students knew an adult besides their teachers who had even graduated from high school. And they didn't know that as teachers we graduated from college. I mean, that's just kind of, in terms of the distance of, you know, college education. Oh, there's another one. The average, so there's 50% will graduate reading on average at 8th grade level. The average African American and Latino student who graduates from high school will perform at the 8th grade level. That's kind of a, you can almost infer that based on how we were talking about the data. So is there one of these that kind of speaks to you?
I can't get over your 8th grade homeroom.
About the what?
Your 8th grade homeroom.
Yeah, I know that's a fact. I couldn't get over it either.
No, I'm just astounded. Like, that, I mean, everything else is nice and social statistics, but the 8th graders that you're looking at in 8th grade.
Yeah. That was
kind of something similar to that when you said that your students didn't realize you graduated from college. I was speaking to a prospective freshman. I was registering a freshman, and I made a comment about a bachelor's degree, and he said, well, what's that? And I'm in a 4-year college beginning law courses and stuff. So what's a bachelor's? Well, it's what you're going to do.
Yeah. I mean, and those are things that, again, we kind of take for granted that a student's going to know what a bachelor, a master's, a PhD is. Every time I talk to my kids about college, I talk to them, this is what a bachelor's is, this is what a master's is. When my students, when they track their grades, so when they saw they were each assigned to college, and that was who they were, like, when they said their name on there, they were at college, and that's how they looked it up, because I had to constantly reinforce college, 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 college.
This prison's being built on 3rd grade scores is, to me, that just speaks of such hopelessness, that you would assume that, you know, based on what you are as a child, that inevitably you will commit a crime and, you know, go to prison, and I think, for me, a prison is sort of the exact opposite of human flourishing. It's like human glue, basically.
It's crazy. So, in Nashville, Randy, so there's a company. What's a corporation for? So there's a company that. But anyway, the company that builds prisons is now trying to get an education. So they're like, hey, we know how to educate kids. And it's like, not necessarily. It's not the same. It's not the same thing. Because, I mean, it really is. With all this bad news, I mean, there really is good news. I mean, I wouldn't be here if there wasn't good news. I wouldn't be here if I felt like, oh, God, like, you know, kids can't learn and this is hopeless. And, you know, I know kids can learn. I mean, I saw it, fortunately, with my own eyes, but I mean, within Teach for America, we've seen it. But there, even outside of Teach for America, you see it. I mean, raise your hand if you've taught or you're a teacher, is there? So, I mean, y'all have seen, I mean, you see it. You see the actual proofs of the possible. I'll say it a few more times, but you see it. So, just a little bit about how we've seen it within Teach for America world. So, one of it is kind of the quality of the input. So, core members have an average GPA of 3.6, an average SAT of 1320, which is remarkable, and 29% people of color. The Urban Institute, there have been a couple of studies. The Urban Institute is one, found that the incremental impact of having a Teach for America core member is 3 times the incremental impact of having a teacher with 3 or more years of experience. Experience does count. I mean, I say having taught, I mean, experience is great. I also know that putting someone in who's got the heart and the mind and the vision in the training is also going to make a huge difference. 95% of principals rate Teach for America core members as effective as or more effective than other first-year teachers. This is what really matters to me. Core members make, on average, 1.5 years of growth with their students. And it matters because if students are behind, the math has to work, they have to do more than a year's worth. Sometimes when we as adults get into these things, well, we can't expect them to make more than a year. We have to expect them to make, I mean, that's the only way we're gonna get them prepared for college by the time it's ready for them to be in college. So that's the stat that really matters to me. Mathematica found that Teach for America core members make more progress in 1 year than would typically be expected. You can dig into the studies. They're all on the website, teachforamerica.org, because that's kind of a fluffy language, more than what would typically be expected. But you can dig into the studies on the website. And then in my classroom, kind of my personal testimony was my students, when I was able to loop with my students, and so when I got them as seventh graders, they were on a sixth grade level. When I left them at the end of their eighth grade year, they were on average at the ninth grade level. So I saw them go from being below grade level. And then it makes such a difference, like when I hear from my students who are in high school and going to high school feeling prepared versus overwhelmed and behind. It makes such a difference for kind of the rest of their trajectory. So, you mean, I don't want to just focus on Teach for America teachers. I mean, Marva Collins is kind of an old school educator who folks know from back in the day. Jaime Escalante, Ray Fesquith, Ricky Sells is my across the hall neighbor who was just, I mean, awesome. Been teaching for probably 30 years, just an amazing teacher. And proved time and time again that when students and families, I mean, it's not just, you're not just working with the student, you are working with the family, are held to high expectations, they meet them. Teach for America has more than 14,000 alumni. They've started schools. KIPP is a national network of charter schools. I mean, burnout is a factor. IDEA, which is in the Rio Grande Valley. So, again, areas we don't necessarily think of, but the Rio Grande Valley has a huge need. Yes College Preparatory. These are all networks of high-performing schools serving low-income students. Both IDEA and Yes were on the Newsweek Top 100. Newsweek or U.S. News? I think it was U.S. News. Top 100 high schools list. And so if you look at a lot of the schools that are serving low-income students who are on these lists, a lot of them are charter schools or kind of education reform. KIPPsters, so KIPP, there's 66 schools across the country. They start fifth grade on average at the 32nd percentile in reading and the 40th percentile in math. After 4 years, they're the 60th percentile in reading and the 82nd percentile in math. So it's possible. Like it takes a lot of work. They spend more time in school. They go to school every other Saturday. Teachers give them their cell phones. So, like I said, it's not the teaching I had. My parents, you know, when I went home, my parents helped me with my homework if I had questions. So it's not the same thing, but it's possible. It's what's required. 67% of Teach for America's alumni remain in education. The National Teacher of the Year, Disney Teacher of the Year, 2008 Teachers of the Year for both the states of Arizona and South Dakota. There's this new organization called the U.S. Public Service Academy that an alumni is trying to start that will basically be like a military academy, but instead of going into the military, you'll go into U.S. service. So you can also look that up online. There are pastors of churches in Virginia and Denver, a multimillionaire hedge fund manager. I mean, people go on and do all sorts of things. They go to law school. There's someone who taught in South Dakota who's going back to South Dakota after medical school to set up a clinic. I mean, there's so many different ways that you can serve low-income communities, but I think teaching kind of gives you a starting point, and hopefully for a lot of folks, an ending point. Like, a lot of folks will stay in there and keep doing it, but other folks will, kind of like you went in there and you saw something, and then you're like, this is how I can go into the system and fix it for low-income students, for all students. I mean, our system.
Well, I was being working.
Yeah, but you saw kind of.
I was working with the supposedly the best of the best with private schools, and I was just, it's nauseating at some time, because you just realize just, there are so many things structurally that go against our students, both high-performing and low-performing. We put so many barriers in a way that just don't need to be there.
Yeah, so I mean that's kind of an example of how you kind of feed back into the theme again of human flourishing. Once you're there, you kind of will pick up, it'll kind of speak to wherever your heart is and your skills are, and you'll go back out into the world and take that with you. I was going to tell more specific stories. These are my kids. This is Daniela and Victor, and I had both of them for 2 years. This is on our way to Washington, D.C., so every year the 8th graders, well, every year starting 2 years ago, eighth graders go on a field trip from Washington, D.C., and we're from Houston, so that's quite a trek. The first year, they went on plane. The second year, we had to do different fundraising, so we went by bus and stopped in Atlanta. But both of these are students who I know whose educational, and I speak specifically about math, because I taught math, their math kind of prospects could have been very different. She is naturally super-duper gifted in math. I told her all the time, she's probably has better math gifts than I do, I mean, for sure. But she came in seventh grade as an English language learner. So a lot of people assume, oh, you don't speak English, you must not be very smart. You know, she's a math genius. So the students don't have to take the state test and pass it, but she passes her seventh grade year, and she was commended, which was kind of like the top 10%, her eighth grade year. And I think that's truly just the difference between someone seeing her and seeing how smart she is versus seeing her language. The second kid, Victor, he was, when I got him as a 10th grader, he was on a 5th grade level. And what's hard about teaching math, I think even a little more so than English sometimes, is then kids get kind of a math, well, I'm just not a math person. And then their parents will frequently feed it to, yeah, I wasn't good at math either, you're just not good at math. And so I found a lot of my kids had that math gap, and I'm like, oh, this is middle school math, so we can't really, you know, we can't just say we're not good at math, because middle school math is the math we just need for life. So Victor, though, for some reason, this is how you see miracles, because for some reason, that class like was just super duper inspired and motivated, and so worked really hard. I mean, Victor would call, kind of get homework help, and so by the end of his eighth grade, he didn't pass as a sixth grader. He passed barely as a seventh grader the test, and then by eighth grade, he was only 20 points from being commended. So he passed, and he was almost at the kind of. And now, I mean, he totally considers himself good at math. Like, he wouldn't. He really does consider himself good at math, and he is. So those are, again, kind of just examples of the actual proving the possible. So now we're going to spend some time kind of thinking about, again, we started this a little bit, the opportunity for human flourishing. There is a problem, and is a solution. There are solutions. So now what? So these are just some perspectives of Teach for America Corps members and InterVarsity alumni. So I just thought I kind of find these inspiring, so I'd love to read these together. And then we'll talk kind of more about ways in which folks might be interested in working towards this. Timothy, do you want to read the first one? I know they're small.
Okay. I chose to serve an under-resourced student population in the Teach for America because I wanted to spend time the first weeks of my education.
I thought that was an interesting way of looking at things. He said, I don't have money. All I got is my education. So why don't I add that?
The roots of my faith call for justice and mercy. I saw that Teach for America was also rooted in the mission to bring justice to students. That was powerful in my decision to join the Corps.
Jason?
I felt strongly called both to teaching and to urban ministry. I knew I wanted to teach in an under-resourced urban community, and Teach for America provided a network and support system in which I could do so effectively.
Emily?
Jesus was the greatest teacher of all. What better way to show the love of Christ than to be a living example to students on a day-to-day basis, giving them the opportunity to do something in life and to show others how valuable they are to our society.
Every Friday I'll send out to my team like some of these just to remind them this is who we're finding. We're finding these leaders of faith.
I was led to join Teach for America through my relationship with Jesus, through my own educational opportunities. I deepened my faith, and I believe strongly that God's desire was for me to give others that same opportunity.
Yeah, okay. And so the first thing is their college, and the second part is what region they're teaching in.
As a Christian, I feel called to be engaged with issues of justice in my community and my country. The issue I feel personally called to is education. Institutional injustices that exist based on socioeconomic status are not simply a social issue that can be left for the government to solve. I believe that the church is meant to work towards justice and shalom, towards things being the way that they should be rather than being content with the way things are.
So we sent out a survey I don't know how many people, but we got 200 alumni to write back, and they told us what organizations they were part of and asked them to kind of reflect on teaching and the intersection of faith. So these are just some of them. There are a lot more, but like I said, I just find it an interesting kind of perspective to kind of hear from some of them. All right, so I'll tell you kind of my professional quandary that I frequently have, which is, this is a group of folks, which is awesome, who for one reason or the other, as you kind of reflected, have come to a conclusion that educational inequity is something we should care about. The quandary is, we are a part of a larger Christian community, and trying to have more of us as Christians care about the educational prospects of all of our children. So discussion questions, and you can kind of return to your groups, and then we'll share out again. How can we as Christians adopt the educational life prospects of our nation's low-income students as our responsibility? Like, what does it take? I mean, this really is like a professional quandary, and where the intersection of my faith and my work really intersect, and where I feel really badly if I don't kind of come up with some thoughts on this soon. So that's kind of the first question. The second question, what gifts and talents do you have personally to offer towards solving this injustice? And then the third is, how can you invest your campus or your religious community in the issue of educational inequity? And some of the ideas coming up about helping students who come and are academically behind. I mean, I feel like that's one example. And even just starting, even if your answer to the question is another question, then I mean, I think that's a starting point also. So you can turn to your groups and kind of discuss. And I'll give you a load of things to talk about, so we'll just kind of discuss it in a bigger group in about 6 minutes. Trying to figure out how can I help that patient, you know. Teaching's not necessarily where I want to be. But these are also, while you're thinking and talking, I just kind of hear a couple of ideas of while you're talking, you kind of thinking through things. So you can kind of marry yourself to some of these ideas too. So go ahead, sorry, continue.
Thank you.
Yay! All right, let's pray together so we can hear from each other. Take about 20 seconds to finish up your thoughts, or less. Okay, y'all are a fast group. All right, I would love to hear some thoughts, and it was good. I mean, to hear people kind of thinking through, like, well, here's what I'm good at. Here's what my skill sets are. Here, how ways we maybe can help. You can answer any one of the three questions. So, who has something they want to contribute? Maybe it's that group? Do y'all have a thought on any one of these three?
Sorry, well, you're looking at us. Right? Uh-huh. Well, what were your time? We got excited, or I got excited because Jean knew quite a bit about this question I asked at the beginning about how to help poorly prepared students transition to college. So that's what we've been talking
about. We can share that out too.
And what she's been telling us is that there are a number of successful programs around the country working with underprepared high school students when they've been admitted to college to help them get up to speed. But what she was saying was that her conviction was that it's really important to give them that extra boost. Because I had been asking, well, what do you do about the fact of, you know, do you make the students feel awkward if you say, yes, you're in, but you need to do this sort of remedial preparation before you start? So that's just what we were whispering about. And Kimberly was telling us about a model she'd seen to prepare business school students in the same way. She didn't think, not sort of underprepared, but just non-traditional, so she didn't think they well.
Get it in, but it's also difficult. Also, you have to build that culture. So you have to build a culture around that. People who came to the military that time, so that's
what I'm doing.
Is it
a math camp?
No.
The same concept. You identify people who have preparation deficits, and it's just assumed that here's something they do. It's not a big deal.
Do you all have thoughts about, even for that, how can we get Christians to care? Is that something that people in your community will care about? Have you brought that as an issue? Like, hey, we've got kids coming to college and they're paying good money and they're not prepared. Is that something people would easily get?
I think one of the things that we have to do as Christians, we need to change the tenor of the conversation. I mean, what does it mean to read at third grade reading level? Does it mean that an average amount of third graders, like the top 50% of third graders, are reading these sorts of texts? What does it mean anyway? And I think that as Christians, our call is to move beyond some of the objective measures of the quantitative measure, like the defining natures of successes, and say, really, what are we doing to help people who God has created in His image and likeness realize their potential in Him? And we really need to change that conversation, to recognize that our God is a creative God who created vocations for every one of his children. And how do we come alongside students in those sorts of ways that really equip and empower them to be the people that God has shaped them to be very uniquely?
I mean, I think one thing that we can do, even if we're in our education positions, is we'll organize these kind of things. They have, you know, Chicago has a thing where they have people come to meet you with parents and some of the classes. It's something we should do with other places, right? I think we with the Head Start kind of programs.
So you're saying, like, organize and then to build awareness, but also to kind of actually help to go back out to the community? And
well, I mean, it's a lot of interaction with institutions of some authority at the university, right? They actually make new things at the university, right? We can actually organize these programs. Mm-hmm. We can have outreach events, we can invite the students to come in. There's like a splash thing that MIT in Chicago. They have, like, they just invite high school students to come in to the university for a day and just take classes and whatever, you know,
that
kind of stuff is successful.
Kind of thing is amazing for kids get so excited to go to a college campus. I mean, they will ask you so many questions. I mean, that type of thing. Like, if you connected with a teacher in your community and said, hey, you want to bring some of your kids here on a day, like, you choose the kids, I'll have a schedule for them. That's a great example.
The undergraduate school that I went to had a few programs like that were combined standing programs where tutoring in inner city schools and we were going back and forth. We weren't right in an urban area, but we had to figure out our own transportation, and we had like homework, tutoring, and mentoring programs that were going on all year long, the entire 4 years. And many of those students continued on to be first generation college students from those high schools that went to our college, and they had summer programs.
They ended up going to your college?
Yeah. And many of them went on to be education majors and were in their education classes with me, and it was a wonderful thing to witness. And it was government funded, and it's always threatening to be cut, but it's just like a phenomenally successful program, and it was just a really cool thing to be a part of and to see at the different stages how it worked for people.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's what it is, because I was talking to someone who had a multicultural program at a college that's not very diverse, and she was wondering about the diversity. I was saying, you know, it would be amazing to see, because this year there were 40 Teach for America core members who were taught by Teach for America core members, so 40 new people who were taught by Teach for America core members. And then you start to see, like, when folks are going to your alma mater, and, you know, I can't wait for where they one of my students goes to Howard or Stanford. But just kind of seeing that ripple effect that happens. From knowing someone who made connections with someone who's on a college campus, and then that becomes their, then that's within their known world.
So what concrete idea of what, or an imagined idea would be to, for how to engage Christian community with these kinds of things would be to approach churches of a certain size or whatever to see if their members can also get involved in these same kinds of, you know, tutoring and other sort of supplemental activity things where it's a relatively small time commitment, you know, as compared to going in for Teach for America, to let a larger number of people participate in a small way. And I guess the thought I would have is that I think that how satisfying and successful an experience volunteers like that have really depends on how well they're trained. And so trained and also supervised and mentored, but especially how well they're trained at the outset. I mean, you can, you know, kids size visitors to their community up and nothing flat. And so how you come in that first minute really matters. So so I guess what I'm wondering is, are there examples of good training preparation?
I don't know about training, but I know at Randy's school there, you want to tell what
they're doing? Yeah, we have a lot of churches in Nashville, out of different denominations to reach out to us. And so one of them has put together, and this is mostly like 20s, 30 something, mostly it's a PCA church, young professionals. They make about 40 of them have made a commitment to go to
come. It's
a 6-week commitment to do a reading program. Mm-hmm. So we have a staff member, actually two staff members who sponsor that. And then our reading teachers also come for actually 7 weeks, because they come in on the first week and they train. They basically train them to do what, to do some small function of what they do in the classroom. So it's all very normalized. Yeah, a Baptist church that has a huge youth group, and they come over for weeks on end in the summer and paint and move stuff and do all sorts of stuff. They've been very proactive. They saw the challenge. There's an Episcopalian church, which happens to have a lot of money, and so they sought us out. And they've I think a year ago they had additional, I guess, income, so they tied their income after the budget overage to us. It was $25,000 to start with.
So, I mean, what this sounds to me like a terrific, very successful relationship. And I guess what I'm wondering is, can you all share the fruits of what you've done? Because I'm sure that a good chunk of it is that you set those volunteers up for success. You know, because the thing that will make a church care about something is if a lot of its individual members have had personal experiences that make them care about these things, as opposed to if somebody stands up and preaches to them and says, about this or whatever. You know, it's actually going in and having a positive experience. to make available, here are the lessons we've learned about how to help your volunteers have a really successful experience.
The approach of the Episcopal Church, I thought was really pretty great, because they had a process that they went through. They scoured the city and they sent people to different
schools. Due diligence, basically.
Was that? Yeah, they did due diligence, basically. They looked at the business investment. And then they found us and through that cultivated the relationships here.
But those are some things, yeah, I think those are some things that definitely we can write up. And I have papers that you can fill out if you want more information. Just put it as, I mean, this is kind of for undergrads, so put as much or as little. Basically, just make sure you put your name and your email, and if you want more information and kind of some things you're interested in, and I'll also send that stuff out, because that's something that I think we should start writing down and collecting. And it might be out there, and I'll kind of look first, but my guess is probably not out there.
I think that there's also a responsibility to sort of expose the structures that are there. One of my projects right now is I'm working on writing a play that can be produced. It's called Overheard in the College of Engineering. And it is looking at exposing the issues of math readiness, major selection, and schedule and flexibility, simultaneously proposing solutions. It incorporates voices from students, student advisors, and faculty members. And I'm purposely trying to offer it so it can be performed by any ethnic or gender composition troupe.
Mm-hmm.
But to have something that's exportable that brings a really perfect conversation to a wide audience, I think is something that's really important. And I think that some of the arts gives us ways to gives us insight about how to bring these conversations about very complicated, very strong sociological issues and try to package them in a way that people can understand and start to see why action is needed.
That's great. Other thoughts? What are some other ways and thoughts people have? I thought you were at class, but you kind of flinched.
I actually had more questions in terms of.
That's good too.
Yeah, no, so I was thinking that some of the ways we've been suggesting are trying to sort of clean up a mess made by the structure that Lindsay was talking about. And so my question was really how can we. Because I guess it's more along the lines of what Liz was saying. How can we have those structures adjusted such that that our job is not just to clean up the mess that created at the end of the line, but how do we create a society that's structured in a more just way?
I think that's kind of the second part of the Teach for America mission, but I think that's kind of also the conversation here. Like, I think, are y'all both lawyers?
Yes.
Yeah, so like, because, I mean, I think about, one of the things I think about is I had tons of students who got, social promotion is very common. And there are tons of students who would not be that stressed out about not being promoted if we didn't make it such a big deal. Like, this is sixth grade, this is seventh grade, this is eighth grade. And so there's some students who just need a little more time, and that's okay. But that's, again, one of those structures that just doesn't set students up for success. So how do we change those structures? And it takes policymakers, and it takes lawyers. And, it takes us kind of understanding the system better.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts about changing structures? How do we kind of?
Ginger and I were talking about how our jobs are affected a lot by the administration.
Mm-hmm.
We're limited, for example, by the child left behind and all the testing that goes on and the teaching to the tests and all that. We were saying that it would be beneficial for Christians to begin leadership positions in order to affect policy. Because a lot of the policy.
And have those conversations.
I think it's important for us to have more discussion in our churches on these kinds of issues than at least what I've experienced in the churches I've been part of. And also, as far as training volunteers, the organization I was part of in Columbus was not a faith-based organization, although there were many people of faith who were part of it. And so I think we shouldn't be afraid to look for nonprofits that are doing this work that maybe are not faith-based, but a place where we did very extensive training of volunteers. particularly in the area of college admission advising and financial aid. So, you know, there sometimes you can look for those kinds of organizations that are already in place and work through those as well.
Yeah, we were talking actually about even on college campuses, how much separation there tends to be between Christian organizations and then organizations that tend to be doing social justice work, which we need to really merge the two. And that's also how we can kind of get our testimony on more, is that we're doing social justice work, but I think that's a great point.
I also think that it's really important that we equip and empower educational researchers to do research in particular communities, because the thing about education is it's an open system where all of the local inputs matter. It matters who the students are, it matters, you know, it matters who those teachers are, it matters, like, to really make the relevant literature accessible to practitioners in meaningful ways. I mean, there is phenomenal research done about the development of student identities in urban schools, but how many just Teach for America core members actually have access to that research in an accessible way that's not full of jargon, that really brings it down to that practical point of, as an educator, this is what you can do, or as educators, this is the way that we can invite you into this research process, because this is what we would kind of need to know, to say, we've got some things, but here's how you can implement it in our classroom, and these are the types of feedback we need as education researchers and curriculum designers to iterate, to improve, to make it better, to suit your students and your needs, but to really just make that
common. Yeah. Yeah. I've got a lot of ideas here from things that you all said, from looking at nonprofits, best practices, and kind of mirroring churches to those. Building a culture around kind of volunteerism, building a culture around college readiness, changing the tenor of our conversation, creating plays, or different kind of thinking of how we can kind of creatively use the arts. Any other thoughts? Christian leadership, getting Christian leadership. Leadership is actually huge. Any other thoughts? Okay, so I kind of had these ideas. This actually is a picture, I believe this is at Pepperdine, of students at Pepperdine making Christmas cards for alumni of Pepperdine who are now Teach for America Corps members, students. So students from Pepperdine could come up during one of their breaks and just make Christmas cards. So I say that to say there are things that you can do from a very small level. BYU, they're hosting a huge pencil drive that they're going to send to one of the schools down in the Rio Grande Valley. So there's so many different levels of things. When I was in business school, I have a dream tutor. That was probably my first toe in the door of like education and teaching. So just keep those things in mind, but whatever you do, may promote excellence for students in low-income communities, because, I mean, they have plenty of issues around them, but the one disservice we would do them is if we don't hold our students to high expectations and really expect a lot out of them and kind of see their potential. So, closing thought?
I just really wanted to plug Donors Choose.
Oh, yeah.
That is spectacular, because the teachers are basically saying, I have a real idea that I want to do with my real kids, and this is what I need to make it happen. And they're fun. They have projects for everything. Like, you can, like, send kids to baseball games, or you can buy books, or you can...
It's awesome. I had a Donor's Choose project on there. I don't know, y'all. When I had homeroom was a big waste of time back when I was in school. And so I did not want my kids to have a big waste of time. So I wanted... There's Stephen Covey has a book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. His Sam wrote a book, The Six Most Important Decisions You'll Ever Make, and so I want each of my homeroom students to have a copy. And so I put that up there for 30 books so that each student could have a copy, and we went through it every homeroom, and it talks about big decisions you make about drugs and sex, and you know, but it's got the right perspective. So so I was able to get that off of Donors Choose. Like, I don't know who the people are who funded me even. I mean, like, some of it's anonymous, but it's an amazing kind of quick way. And you can just give $20, $10. So those are kind of some ideas. Thanks for the plug.
It's awesome. I had so much fun.
Well, something else you can do too is if you want to get like your fraternity or like just kind of a group of friends, like, hey, let's look through a project and see one that we want to fund, and then you can kind of as a collective fund, you know, it's so amazing because teachers will go back and they'll track and see like what percent of their project was funded, what percent of their project was funded. So for them to like pop on one day and see that their project was funded and the supplies are on the way, or their kids are going to get to go on that field trip, or, you know, they're going to get the Spanish books for their class, or, you know, they're going to get a smart car, like all sorts of fun things. So These are a couple of books I recommend, depending on, So now my kind of favorite book that I'm reading now is this book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know if anyone started reading that yet. But he's got some really interesting observations on education in there, a couple of chapters. And it's basically about how things that we consider to be success aren't just success, that you have to kind of look under success. So I'll give away one little point so you'll kind of see why I like this book. So for example, in Canada, people think, if you look at kind of the top Canadian hockey players, most of them are born in January, February, and March. And the reason for that is because the cutoff date is January for when you can start. So all the kids are starting more developed in January, February, and March. Therefore, they get more playing time. Therefore, their team is more successful. And so it's kind of a, so he looks at a lot of different examples like that in the book Outliers. And he's got some education kind of pieces in there. So again, these are kind of a combination of books. There are probably more, but and book training. Okay.
These slides online anywhere? Are they on the website?
No, but I can send them out.
If you want to, if folks want to fill this out, I'm sorry, I should have said it earlier. If you want like slides or anything.
And also, if you want my information, I have cards up here. But if you have questions, thoughts, ideas, a flourishing moment where you're kind of like wondering about something, cards, or here's my information here, I'd be more than thrilled to talk to anyone. So we're still kind of new in our marriage of you know faith communities and Teacher America. So. Thank you. Thank you all again for coming and participating and you know, engaging, because you certainly could have been more reserved. So thank you. Thank you very
much.
Yeah, you just leave it there.
Did you work at Bridgestone?
I did.
I used to work there.
Did you?
Yeah.
Were you
I was in Boston. I was there.